David ran barefooted in the soft earth of the road. He ran without feeling his bruised and torn skin, without feeling the pounding of his heart nor the protest of his lungs. As the road rounded the shoulder of the hill and dipped towards the homestead, he stopped abruptly and stared, panting, at the lurid glow of the arc lights that floodlit the grounds and garden of Jabulani. It made no sense that the floodlights should be burning, and David felt a fresh flood of alarm. He sprinted on down the hill. He ran through the empty ransacked rooms, shouting her name, but the echoes mocked him. When he reached the front veranda, he saw something moving in the darkness beyond the broken screen door. Zulu, he ran forward. Here, boy, here, here, boy. Where is she? The dog staggered up the steps towards him. His tail wagged a perfunctory greeting, but he was obviously hurt. A heavy blow along the side of his head had broken the jaw, or dislocated it, so that it hung lopsided and grotesque. He was still stunned, and David knelt beside him. Where is she, Zulu? Where is she? The dog seemed to make an effort to gather its scattered wits. Where is she, boy? She's not in the house. Where is she? Find her, boy, find her. He led the Labrador out into the yard and followed gamely as David circled the house. At the back door, Zulu picked up the scent on the fresh, damp earth. He started resolutely towards the gate, and David saw the footprints in the floodlights, Deborah's and the big masculine prints which ran after them. As Zulu crossed the yard, David turned back into his office. The lantern was missing from its shelf, but there was a 5-cell flashlight near the back. He shoved it into his pocket and grabbed a handful of shotgun shells. Then he went quickly to the gun cabinet and unlocked it. He snatched the Purdy shotgun from the rack and loaded it as he ran. Zulu was staggering along the path beyond the gates, and David hurried after him. Johann Ackers was no longer a human being. He had become an animal. The spectacle of the running quarry had roused the predator's single-minded passion to chase and drag down and kill. Yet it was seasoned with a feline delight in torment. He was playing with his wounded, dragging prey, running it when he could have ended it, drawing it out, postponing the climax, the final, consuming thrill of the kill. The moment came at last, some deep atavistic sense of the ritual of the hunt, for all sport killing has its correct ceremony, and Ackers knew it must end now. He came up behind the running figure and reached out to take a twist of the thick dark hair in the crippled claw of his hand, wrapping it with a quick movement about his wrist and jerking back her head, laying open the long pale throat for the knife. She turned upon him with a strength and ferocity he had not anticipated. Her body was hard and strong and supple, and now that she could place him, she drove at him with the wild terror of a hunted thing. He was unprepared. Her attack took him off balance, and he went over backwards with her on top of him, and he dropped the knife and the lantern into the grass to protect his eyes, for she was tearing at them with long, sharp nails. He felt them rip into his nose and cheek, and she screeched like a cat, for she was also an animal in this moment. He freed the stiff claw from the tangle of her hair, and he drew it back, holding her off with his right hand, and he struck her. It was like a wooden club, stiff and hard and without feeling. A single blow with it had stunned the Labrador and broken his jaw. It hit her across the temple, a sound like an axe swung at a tree trunk. It knocked all the fight out of her, and he came up on his knees, holding her with his good hand, and with the other he clubbed her mercilessly, beat her head back and across with a steady rhythm. In the light of the fallen lantern, the black blood spurted from her nose, and the blows cracked against her skull, steady and unrelenting. Long after she was still and senseless, he continued to beat her. Then at last he let her drop, and he stood up. He went to the lantern and played the beam in the grass. The knife glinted up at him. There is an ancient ceremony with which a hunt should end. The culminating ceremony of the Gralach, when the triumphant huntsman slits open the paunch of his game and thrusts his hand into the opening to draw out the still warm viscera. Johann Ackers picked the knife out of the grass and set down the lantern so the beam fell upon Deborah's supine figure. He went to her, and with his foot rolled her onto her back. The dark black mane of sodden hair smothered her face. He knelt beside her and hooked one iron-hard finger into the front of her blouse. With a single jerk, he ripped it cleanly open, and her big round belly bulged in the lantern light. It was white and full and ripe, with the dark pit of the navel in its center. Akkas giggled and wiped the rain and sweat from his face with his arm. Then he changed his grip on the knife, reversing it so the blade would go shallow, opening the paunch neatly from crotch to ribcage without cutting into the intestines, a stroke as skillful as a surgeon's that he had performed 10,000 times before. Movement in the shadows at the edge of the light caused him to glance up. He saw the black dog rush silently at him, saw its eyes glow in the lantern light. He threw up his arm to guard his throat, and the furry body crashed into him. They rolled together, with Zulu mouthing him, unable to take a grip with his injured jaws. Akkas changed his grip on the hilt of the carving knife and stabbed up into the dog's ribcage, finding the faithful heart with his first thrust. Zulu yelped once and collapsed. Akkas pushed his glossy black body aside, pulling out the knife, and he crawled back to where Deborah lay. The distraction that Zulu had provided gave David a chance to come up. David ran to Akkas, and the man looked up with the muddy green eyes glaring in the lantern light. He growled at David with the long blade in his hand, dulled by the dog's blood. He started to come to his feet, ducking his head in exactly the same aggressive gesture as the bull baboon. David thrust the barrels of the shotgun into his face, and he pulled both triggers. The shot hit solidly, without spreading, tearing into him in the bright yellow flash and thunder of the muzzle blast, and it took away the whole of Akka's head above the mouth, blowing it to nothingness. He dropped into the grass with his legs kicking convulsively, and David hurled the shotgun aside and ran to Deborah. He knelt over her, and he whispered, "Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, forgive me, please forgive me, I should never have left you." Gently he picked her up, and holding her to his chest, he carried her up to the homestead. Deborah's child was born in the dawn. It was a girl, tiny and wizened and too early for her term. If there had been skilled medical attention available, she might have lived, for she fought valiantly. But David was clumsy and ignorant of the succor she needed. He was cut off by the raging river, and the telephone was still dead, and Deborah was still unconscious. When it was over, he wrapped the tiny little blue body in a clean sheet and laid it tenderly in the cradle that had been prepared for her. He felt overwhelmed by a sense of guilt at having failed the two persons who needed him. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, Conrad Berg forced a passage of the Luzzani stream with the water boiling above the level of the big wheels of his truck, and 3 hours later they had Deborah in a private ward of the Nelspruit Hospital. 2 days later she became conscious once more, but her face was grotesquely swollen and purple with bruises. Near the crest of the koppie that stood above the homestead of Jabulani, there was a natural terrace, a platform which overlooked the whole estate. It was a remote and peaceful place, and they buried the child there. Out of the rock of the koppie, David built a tomb for her with his own hands. It was best that Deborah had never felt the child in her arms or at her breast, that she had never heard her cry or smelled the puppy smell of her. Her mourning was therefore not crippling and corrosive, and she and David visited the grave regularly. One Sunday morning, as they sat upon the stone bench beside it, Deborah talked for the first time about another baby. "You took so long with the first one, Morgan," she complained. "I hope you've mastered the technique." They walked down the hill again, put the rods and a picnic basket into the Land Rover, and drove down to the pools. The Mozambique bream came on the bite for an hour just before noon, and they fought over the fat yellow wood grubs that David was baiting. Deborah hung 5, all around 3 pounds in weight, and David had a dozen of the big blue fish before it went quiet, and they propped the rods and opened the cold box. They lay together on the rug beneath the outspread branches of the fever trees and drank white wine cold from the icebox. The African spring was giving way to full summer, filling the bush with bustle and secret activity. The weaver birds were busy upon their basket nests, tying them to the bending tips of the reeds, fluttering brilliant yellow wings as they worked with black heads bobbing. On the far bank of the pool, a tiny bejeweled kingfisher sat his perch on a dead branch above the still water, plunging suddenly, a speck of flashing blue to shatter the surface and emerge with a silver sliver wriggling in his outsized beak. Hosts of yellow and bronze and white butterflies lined the water's edge below where they lay, and the bees flew like golden motes of light to their hive in the cliff high above the quiet pools. The water drew all life to it, and a little after noonday, David touched Deborah's arm. "The Inyala are here," he whispered. They came through the grove on the far side of the pool, timid and easily spooked. They approached a few cautious steps at a time before pausing to stare about them with huge dark eyes, questing muzzles and widespread ears. Striped and dainty and beautiful, they blended with the shadows of the grove. "The does are all belly now," David told her. "They'll be dropping their lambs within the next few weeks. Everything is fruitful." He half turned towards her, and she sensed it and moved to meet him. When the Inyala had drank and gone, and a white-headed fish eagle circled high above them on dark chestnut wings, chanting its weird and haunting cry, they made love in the shade beside the quiet water.